This is Layla Mudin, RD. I see patients every day here at the Hoffman Center. If you require a nutrition consult with me, but live out of town, there's no need to travel to New York City. I have telephone consultations with clients from all over the country. Please visit drhoffman.com for more information. And to set up an appointment, call 212-779-1744. That's 212-779-1744. I look forward to being a collaborator in your healthcare.
Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and it's our weekly Q&A with Layla, wherein we answer your questions. You can send your questions to radioprogram@AOL.com. And today we're with Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mudin. How you doing, Layla?
Okay, Dr. Hoffman. How are you doing?
Good. And we get quite a lot of questions, don't we?
Yes.
Yeah, so we're running about two, 3 weeks behind.
Yeah. Six to 8 weeks.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
We're getting a lot of questions, which is wonderful, everybody.
No dearth of questions. But so if you sent a question, we reserve the right to be selective about questions. Some questions may be too involved or detailed to be properly handled in a quick podcast consult. Some questions may be off target or redundant. But the majority of questions we answer. So please be patient. Keep listening. And just a program note for those of you in New York who listen to me via WOR, Radio 710 in New York City, we're switching stations. We've got a new station.
Oh.
Yep. WVNJ, which is 1160 AM. And there's a time change. The show will be heard Saturdays from noon to 1 p.m., although for our national audience and those who listen via the Internet, the show will be the same. It'll be from noon to 2 p.m. Saturdays Eastern Time. But this affects listeners in the New York area who listen via WOR.
Terrific.
And so we're moving to a new platform. And I'm excited about it because there's a lot of health programming on WVNJ. It's a station that's kind of situates us within a weekend block of health programs. So
wonderful.
I think it's
wonderful. And it's 1160 a.m.?
1160 a.m. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay. So we had a question, and it's kind of a provocative question about probiotics. What was that question?
Yes. Robert writes, why does one continually take probiotics? Wouldn't your gut eventually be seeded with good bacteria?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
At least until you take an antibiotic and disrupt everything?
Right. This is a really good question because it is it sort of makes intuitive sense that, say, you're missing certain good bacteria, and then you put the good bacteria into your gut via probiotic, and they take hold and proliferate in your gastrointestinal tract.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the end of the story. And it's kind of like, Farmer John, with his bag of seeds, in the old days before they had, tractors seeding the fields, with his burlap bag of seeds, going up and down the rows of seeds and spreading the seed into the soil, and then the rains come and the seeds germinate, and it's all good, right?
Yeah.
It's not quite so simple with probiotics because there's several limiting factors. One is the probiotic viable? Okay.
Yes.
Number two is the probiotic going to survive its transit down into the gastrointestinal tract. Number three, is it going to successfully compete with the other bacteria in your gastrointestinal tract? And now, as you know, Layla, there's emerging evidence that one's template for bacteria may be genetic. The bacteria that you're able to nurture in your gastrointestinal tract, there's some genetic determinant of what you're going to have like your microbiome fingerprint. And of course, some of this is imprinted from infancy. If you're breastfed, if you, you know, had vaginal birth as opposed to C-section, mm-hmm. you know, if you had antibiotics administered early on, and, you know, there are many factors that change your microbiome. So here's an interesting factoid. All right. I take probiotics every day. In fact, I take Dr. Ahira's, and sometimes I change, you know, I'll play around with some others. I get samples from different companies. But I think in the last 20 years, I've probably taken probiotics, you know, 99% of the time. And I just did a test with a company called Ubiome, which is interesting. If $80, you send them, you know, and then you send a stool sample, and they analyze your microbiome. And they tell you what's there. And what I found to my great surprise is that I have almost zero lactobacillus and almost zero bifidobacteria. Now,
which are the primary probiotics in any probiotic formulation.
Right. Right. Now, what's the interpretation of that? Does that mean I'm wasting my time, or I've been, all the probiotics I've been taking are just junk and they're not doing the job? I choose to interpret a little differently. I think that what happens when you take a probiotic may not be so simple as some people think, is that, you know, you're going to start a thriving colony of whatever you're taking in the probiotic in your gastrointestinal tract. I think for some people that may be the case, and other people there may be limiting factors. But I actually think that probiotics may have a shaping and orchestrating effect on the other bacteria in your gastrointestinal tract, and interact with them in a way that may improve your overall mix of, of bacteria.
Yeah, I mean, anything new in an environment is still going to impact that environment in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah. Right. And so now, on the other hand, what I was gratified to see is there's this kind of a diversity scale. You know, like we're all about diversity, you know, in our schools, in our entertainment, you know, we want African American and Hispanic and Asian, Caucasian in our, you know, whatever, when we're watching a sitcom, that's diversity. But we also want diversity in our gastrointestinal tract, because that bespeaks, a greater level of protection to the immune system and overall improved metabolism and digestion. And it's more akin to our native state, because if you study people in like the Amazon, in these untouched enclaves of human pre-civilization, they have enormous diversity in their gastrointestinal tracts.
Yeah.
And we in the West have very little diversity. And low diversity is associated with illness, and high diversity is associated with wellness and longevity. And I was pleased to see that in spite of the fact I didn't have much of the supposedly good bacteria, that I had a very high diversity score. I think it was like, you know, 88% or 92% in terms of diversity.
Terrific.
In spite of living in the West, and in spite of, you know, having had some antibiotics, you know, because that's, they didn't know any better. And maybe, you know, early in life, maybe not eating so well.
If we want to replicate people living, you know, in nature, the Amazon, all of that, you know, I suppose you could grow your own produce, and when you go out to get a cucumber for your salad in your yard, you know, just kind of wipe it off on your shirt and take a bite.
Yeah, right. Eat dirt. Eat dirt.
Eat dirt. Yeah. Isn't there a book that's
there
called
is.
Eat Dirt?
There is. A book. Yeah. There's a book called The Dirt Cure. We interviewed Dr. Maya Shetreat Klein. She's a pediatric neurologist, and it's quite an excellent book. And her contention is that, you know, it's the hygiene hypothesis restated, which is that we do need to be exposed to bugs to populate our gastrointestinal tracts and our skin microbiome. And to, you know, these are important accompaniments to our oral health. So anyway, so I think probiotic science is kind of, you know, if we were to look by comparison to the history of aviation, you know, and compare it to the history of microbiome science, I think we're in the era where, definitely the Wright brothers have, you know, flown their first plane, but maybe we're in the pre-World War I era. You know, where, you know, plane flying was more common, but it was more like stunt flyers, and it was, you know, not, they didn't have, you know, efficient passenger planes, and warplanes were very primitive. You know, I think that's kind of where we are with probiotics, and it's a field that has tremendous potential, but we, you know, we're in the very early phases of our understanding of how that works.
We also have to understand that many of our foods contain prebiotics, which help support our microbiome as well. So it's important, things like kiwi, asparagus, leeks, onion, garlic, artichoke, Jerusalem artichoke in particular.
So
they help support,
I heard a very interesting lecture. You know, I go to Baltimore to a trade show, and it's called Expo East. And when I go down there, I visit the booths of some of our sponsors, like Kyolic Aged Garlic Extract and Essential Formulas and Clear. And when I went to I hung out a little bit with the people at Essential Formulas that make Dr. Ahira's, and they make RegActive. And I heard a lecture where they presented some interesting information about Dr. Ahira's probiotic. And what they say is that there are prebiotics within the capsule. So what you're getting is not just the actual probiotic. You're getting prebiotics, which help the probiotics survive and also feed other beneficial bacteria in your gastrointestinal tract. But they also introduce the concept of postbiotic. And what that is there are residual, whatever, humoral factors or byproducts of fermentation that are present in Dr. Ahira's, because it's basic, it's more, that's, it's not even so much a probiotic, it's more like a fermented food product.
Yeah, it takes 5 years, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's it's kind of like a super concentrated miso-like product, you know, with live cultures in it. But there's some postbiotic factors that are very interesting, because they may play a role, even though they're not living, they're actually organic chemicals that may be growth factors for beneficial bacteria and may prevent pathogens from arising and encourage the growth of healthy bacteria. It's kind of, it's just, it, they're only scratching the surface of understanding this.
It's like a forest with 400 species of plant life.
Oh, yeah.
Our biome, our microbiome.
Very complicated.
Think of it that way, yeah. Interesting. And, by the way, to Robert, who asked us this question, when you do take a course of antibiotics, yes, take your probiotic, but not at the same time. They should be taken at least 2 hours apart from each other.
Mm-hmm. Good.
That would be a good course of action, yeah. So take your probiotics. Eat probiotic foods.
Mm-hmm.
Sauerkraut, kimchi, lacto-fermented, lactic acid-fermented pickles, like Bubby's. I love Bubby's pickles.
Yeah, and don't get the kind that are that have benzoate in them, because what they do is they they sort of flash kill the ferment because they're afraid that if it stays on the shelf too long, it'll ferment and the pickles become too mushy. So you actually want fresh pickles. Yeah. You want fresh fermented pickles, because the kind that have preservatives in them, they've fermented them, and then they've in effect poisoned the live micro microorganisms in there with a preservative like benzoate, sodium benzoate.
And the same with your sauerkraut and your kimchi. In sauerkraut, a good glass jarred sauerkraut should contain cabbage and salt, and that's it. The kimchi will contain other things, but none of them would be sodium benzoate. Not the real stuff anyway. So Robert, thank you for your question. All right, take your probiotics. We have a very interesting question here, a two-part question from Ricardo. Why does heart valve replacement, both artificial and biological, not cause an immunological reaction? And is it necessary to take blood-thinning medication after a biological replacement?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to try and explain that. There's two kinds of valves. You know, they're what are called artificial valves. And artificial valves are made of Teflon, Dacron, you know, there's sort of a mesh that's in a metal cage. And the object is to find materials that are very inert and that people don't react to. And I suspect that there may be some degree of reactivity among some people. And this is maybe an unrecognized potential issue. And then there's pig valves. Now, if you took a pig valve and, you know, you wiped it off and you just popped it into a human aorta, it would react because it's a foreign material, right? I mean, it's got some DNA and it's got some proteins and it
doesn't belong in your body. That came from somewhere else.
So what they do is they actually, treat it in such a way that they strip away all but the fibrous, inert, platform, for the tissue. So that you're getting, essentially inert tissue that has no cellular, composition and just the structure or the matrix on which the cells grow. And that's, I think, what you're getting when you get a pig valve. Okay. And there, because otherwise, you know, it'd be like an organ transplant. It'd be like getting, if you want to, we don't have enough human kidneys. Well, why don't we just, kill monkeys and just take their kidneys and put them in? No, because you would react.
Yeah.
And so this is different than an organ transplant in that they've stripped away the potentially reactive cells. That's what my take is on that. Okay, so the next question is about that.
Yeah, is it necessary to take blood thinning medication after biological replacement?
Yeah, very.
And if so, why?
Very necessary because there's something about artificial surfaces, and they cannot, Teflon is supposed to be a nonstick surface, right?
Yeah.
And then they have other ways of dealing with that. And by the way, Teflon, when heated is not so great. So I'm wondering if Teflon, at a body.
I was just going to ask you that.
Yeah,
we're not supposed to use Teflon anymore, right?
Yeah,
right. In cooking.
Yeah, right. So I don't even know what the state of the art is, what they're using now, but something that's a nonstick surface. Surfaces that are not our own native surfaces tend to be, likely to, accumulate both bacterial biofilms and also platelets. So when the platelets stick to a non-native surface, they may form a blood clot and then bing, with the next heartbeat, that little tiny blood clot can be dislodged and propelled upwards into your brain, causing a stroke.
Oof.
And that's why people need blood thinning. And I don't know if there's a term limit or time limit on the blood thinning, depending on the different valve. I think there's different approaches.
And you're probably not talking about an ordinary baby aspirin or something either, right? You're
talking about
Plavix or warfarin
or something, along those lines.
Hmm. Wow.
And which is dictated by the type of valve. It's dictated by the type of valve.
Okay. Ricardo, thank you for your very curious and thoughtful question.
Yep.
All right. We have a question from Sydney. Hey, Dr. Hoffman, I've been reading about your studies on olive leaf extract. However, I have a few questions I'd like to ask you, such as, will it cure herpes? And what kind of daily dosage should I take?
Well, the expression
herpes.
Herpes is forever, as they say, until further notice. I mean, they really haven't come up with all the antivirals that they use against herpes. What they do is they control it. They don't eradicate it. So even if it were to be as effective as a, prescription antiviral, it's still not going to eradicate the herpes, which seems to reside deep down within nerves. It herpes is latent within nerves and comes out. So, you know,
olive leaf extract helps boost the immune system to prevent herpes outbreaks. I mean, there are a few things you could do to help prevent herpes outbreaks. Olive leaf is one, taking some additional vitamin C, maybe some selenium or zinc, a very clean diet, a diet that does not suppress your immunity,
mm-hmm.
sleeping, getting the requisite amount of sleep that you need every night,
mm-hmm.
not eating foods that are very high in arginine, you know, too many nuts, that's a lot of arginine, chocolate, mm-hmm. Brussels sprouts, believe it or not, and corn. These foods contain the highest amounts of arginine, but I want you to eat your Brussels sprouts and some occasional dark chocolate and eat your nuts if you wish. You know, so take some additional lysine.
Mm-hmm.
It's really the ratio of arginine to lysine that's important, or rather lysine to arginine.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as lysine has the upper hand, you know, in that ratio, you don't have to be as concerned about arginine.
Mm-hmm.
But just keeping your immune system well. You know, herpes outbreaks happen under stress. Not enough sleep is a stress.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to be just studying for final exams or something like that. Yeah.
Absolutely.
And olive leaf would be part of an immune regimen.
Right.
Dr. Hoffman, do you remember when you used to give us cold packs for the winter?
Oh, yes. That's right. That's right. Yes.
Yeah.
They all contained
olive leaf.
Yeah.
Right.
Olive leaf was important. You know, transfer factor mm-hmm. was important. So let me mention another thing that is particularly helpful, less well known for herpes, is lithium. And lithium mm-hmm. orotate is available as a supplement. There's some evidence that it helps to suppress the herpes virus.
Terrific.
So
right.
Let me come back to the issue of anticoagulation, because I wanted to get this precise. You know, we're talking about heart valves. So
yeah.
I'm looking at the current position of the American College of Cardiology on anticoagulation for valvular heart disease. What they say is that with mechanical valves, yeah, it's lifetime. You have to have anticoagulation forever. With the what's called prosthetic valve replacement, which means the pig valve, they say the optimal antithrombotic regimen and duration after placement of a bioprosthetic device is less clear. So I got it right, but I wanted to be precise about it. So what they say is an advantage of having a pig valve is you don't have to be on anticoagulation for the rest of your life, but certainly for some period of time you do. So they say that you need to do it for at least 3 months, and maybe for longer, and then you don't need to continue with the anticoagulation if you have a pig valve.
All right. So okay. The biological replacement is preferred.
Hmm. Yeah. We're possible. I mean, it's in terms of that advantage.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah,
it's
the mechanical valves are interesting. They're almost like a little ping pong ball in a cage, if you look at them. And the weirdest thing is when you listen to the heartbeat of someone who has one of these valves, because it sounds completely unnatural. It sounds like click, 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 which is not the way a heart sounds, because it's basically that little ping pong ball bouncing up and down in the cage. It's a weird thing.
As opposed to a lub-dub.
As opposed to lub-dub with maybe
lub-dub.
A little murmur, like a whoo. Right.
A Nerf ball in the cage, not a ping pong ball.
Right. So, is there such a thing as a short question?
A short question. Let's see. We've got one from Paul. I remember Carlton Fredericks warning his listeners to avoid nightshades some 40 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
What is your opinion of the vegetables and fruits in the nightshade family? Healthy and delicious or dangerous? I don't think that's a short question, but...
Well, yeah, you know, having just gone out to the... we have an open-air market in our part of Manhattan once a week, and I just scooped up the last of the artisanal tomatoes, you know, those kind of ugly, misshapen tomatoes that taste real good and, you know, are hard to get other than in the summer months. So they seem to be just kind of like the last crop of them. I'm not against taking tomatoes, but I think there are some people who are sensitive to tomatoes. And particularly people with arthritic conditions may benefit from elimination of nightshades. Do you find that?
Yeah, absolutely. Anybody with arthritis, whether it's osteoarthritis, rheumatoid arthritis, they benefit. And it's especially tomatoes, I'm finding out. You know, if they have a if they dabble in a little eggplant here and there, not so much.
Yeah.
But tomatoes, peppers, white potatoes.
Yeah.
Those.
I don't think I have a problem with those things personally. I mean, it's not that I'm not without an occasional, you know, strain or sprain or ache, you know, from my exercise, but you know,
but it's not osteoarthritis.
Yeah.
You know,
I don't have swollen finger joints.
It's also helpful, just to answer Paul's question, it's also helpful to eliminate the nightshades when you have any kind of autoimmune condition.
Yeah, I would say so. It might be worthwhile. Yeah. I mean, there's some really, if you look at Lauren Cordain, who writes about the paleo diet, he's actually the originator of this concept. He has some pretty persuasive biochemical information that suggests that these types of foods may worsen leaky gut, that may be the mechanism by which they create autoimmunity or further inflammatory changes in the body. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. Yeah. Fascinating.
Yeah, but it does is it really argues for an individualized approach to nutrition, which is why we need folks like you, because, you know, how many diets do you have in your head? You know, like 150 or so?
Yeah.
I mean, diets for this, diets for that, you know, low oxalate diets.
It's called MNT. It's called medical nutrition therapy.
Yeah.
For lack of a better word, a better phrase than nutritionist or dietitian, medical nutrition therapist.
Right.
That's really what it is. That's really what I am. Yeah.
Right. And so it's very, you know, like low histamine diet, low oxalate diet, FODMAP diet, GAPS diet, SCD.
Interstitial cystitis diet, all kinds of things.
You name it. All right. Very good. All right. So that being said, this concludes today's edition of our Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Keep those questions coming. Don't give up because we'll eventually get your question. Radio program at AOL.com is the place to go. Or to send your question, and go to drhoffman.com for more information. Please, why don't you like us on Facebook, because you'll be assured of an additional flow of information into your Facebook account. Make sure that you check out our store at drhoffman.com for many of the products that we talk about on these podcasts, and thereby help to support our continuing free distribution of all this good information. Thanks for joining us, Lily.
Thank you, Dr. Hoffman. Thank you, everybody.
I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.